A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Good day to you. I'm trying not to start every podcast going, hello, how are you? Ugh. Every time I record my podcast, some weird noise starts. I think that's Richard in the garden with a leaf blower. Is that very annoying? That's probably a bit too annoying, isn't it? Well, I'll persevere just in case. The thing is, Richard does my editing, so he might decide that he's going to let himself off with a leaf blower and it's not too annoying. I've had to start recording the introduction to this week's podcast 3 times in my house because it's so hard to find a quiet place. So now I'm in my bedroom, actually, sealed away. Rather embarrassingly, I recorded today's guest, Jacqueline Gold, in my house, and it was the most noisy place I've recorded any of my podcasts. So my house is a noisy house. What more can I say? That is the world I live in. I'm really excited about, I get excited about all the guests, I know that. But Jacqueline, for me, was a really special chat because I didn't know her at all. We only met for the first time when we met to have our conversation. And so I was really, really, really happy that she'd said yes, that she wanted to speak to me. So that was lovely. But also she is one of those women that I was kind of always someone I admired from afar. So Jacqueline is the CEO of Ann Summers. And she comes across as a very gentle woman. You'll hear in her voice, she's got a gentle speaking voice. However, she is a very strong, formidable, and actually quite a radical woman. And I think being radical is something that you can maybe push a bit further if you can slightly hypnotize people with a gentle voice. At least I imagine something like that might have happened when, aged 21, she made a decision at the company she was working, Ann Summers, that ended up revolutionizing, I suppose, how the sex shop is on the high street. So back in the early 80s, Jacqueline had the idea when she was working at Ann Summers. She was only planning to work there as a sort of work experience, short-term thing. And back then, women as consumers in the sex industry were only 10% of the consumers. The rest of them were what she called men, the raincoat brigade. So sort of scurrying in and out of the sex shops. But having visited I think she said it was a clothing party that was equivalent to like a Tupperware party. She went there with an Anne Summers colleague, and she thought, hang on a minute, what if we did lingerie and sex toys just for women at parties, like a Tupperware party, but an Anne Summers party? And it changed everything. And now women are 70% of the consumers. They are 70% of the consumers in sex shops, but I doubt that they are 70% of the CEOs. So, Jacqueline is still a trailblazer. She's still a revolutionary kind of woman. And we have a lot to thank her for, because she has changed how women are perceived when it comes to thinking about their sexual selves. You know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, women were still thought to not really enjoy sex and not want to be participating in buying anything that might be just to enhance their pleasure, which is ridiculous, but also such recent history. That's quite scary, isn't it? Anyway, I'm going to emerge from my quiet bedroom and go down into my noisy kitchen to make a cup of tea. If you've listened to me before, you'll know I have it white with one. I'm happy to put on the kettle for you too. I'm going to listen again to the conversation I had with Jacqueline, because I think she's pretty cool and has really done so much. It can't really be underestimated how much she's achieved in her life. She's also mother to a 10-year-old girl and a little boy who she speaks very tenderly and with clarity and practicality and gentleness, who sadly died when he was a few months old. So thank you to Jacqueline for her time, her wisdom, her words, and thank you to you for listening again to me and Jacqueline. So have a listen and see you on the other side. I was thinking about talking to you today. I was thinking what would probably work best is if we both speak at double the pace we do normally, because there's so many things to talk to you about. I don't think I'm going to have long enough. I will do my best to shoehorn it in, but your life has packed in more than most people have. So why don't we start with the here and now? So what is happening in your working life at the moment?
Well, it's quite a challenging time, not just for retail in general, but just because, you know, of the coronavirus, you know, it's really quite, everybody's got to be on their game of how they make it all work.
Yeah.
But that aside, you know, we've got some great things going on. We've just brought out this new range called My Viv, which is all about my very important vagina.
Okay. My Viv.
My Viv.
Okay. Is Viv just like the short name for a vagina?
That's just the short name, but I did manage to get Lorraine Kelly to say vagina twice on Lorraine. So
really?
I feel like there's a big achievement.
That's impressive, actually.
Yeah, I think so. But I think women just generally, we put ourselves second all the time. And, you know, whatever phase of your life, whether you've just had children or you've gone through the menopause or whatever it is, you know, our sexual well-being is really important.
Really important.
So, and it's not something to be trivialised, which is why we sort of brought out this... Well, actually, the reason I brought out this range, and it's a range of... it's got sex toys in it, but it's actually from therapy right through to pleasure. So
okay.
It's candles and, you know, all sorts of things for that whole sort of well-being sort of feeling. But it was because I had breast cancer. I don't know if you know that, but I just thought, when a man goes to the doctor with, I don't know, prostate cancer or something, the first thing the doctor says is, this is going to affect your sex life. But with women, it's not spoken about.
Really?
No. And I just think, you know, there needs to be something that makes women feel more comfortable. So that's really what I've been doing.
Yeah, well, actually, maybe that's the sort of tip of the iceberg, actually, and when it's ever spoken about in relation to much else that's going on with women generally, our sex lives and our relationships with our body in that way. And I know even when you have a baby and all those things, it's not really something that... It's sort of alluded to sometimes about when it might be appropriate time to restart your sex life after you've given birth, but your... You know, the hormones and your emotional thing and your connection with yourself again is not really something that I don't know if I would have known who to speak to about that at the time, or if it's even really given much space.
We often feel embarrassed, or, you know, are they going to think this is silly?
Yeah.
But it's not silly.
Yeah, well, I think also, I don't know, I might be wrong, but certainly, I mean, I'm friends with, I know, the girlfriends where we're very confident about talking about loads of stuff, but I think talking about our sex lives is something that I think is probably, if I drew a, you know, a sort of pie chart of what we talk about, I think it's a really tiny thing, because most people are still maybe very private, but also I feel like it's still quite taboo, maybe even when we were teenagers.
No, my friends talk about it all the time. Yeah, well, maybe it's because of what I do.
Well, no, but that's good, because maybe they felt like it's removed that awkwardness. Because I'm sure once you open the floodgates, there's so much to talk about. And actually what you've talked about with my Viv and the holistic side, the candles and the massage things, that's so key, because it's so emotional. And I think the older you get, the better you get at recognising the need to put that on equal footing, really. It's not going to you're not going to enjoy yourself if you're not emotionally feeling like you've got the space to do that. It's not just a physical need.
Definitely. And, you know, there are things that you worry about. I had a mastectomy in February, and I thought to myself, you know, is my husband still going to fancy me? You know, those are real feelings.
So this is something you've literally just gone through this February just gone?
February last year.
Okay.
The time's flying so fast, but yeah, February last year.
Well, that's a massive deal to go. I mean, yeah, that's... So alongside all the stuff that's happening with Anne Summers at the moment, and this is still presumably a Monday to Friday 9-to-5 job that you're doing all the time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously anybody that's gone through chemotherapy or treatment knows it's a pretty brutal time. And,
yeah.
You've got to listen to your body. But I'm working back full time now, because it was just important to me that as soon as I felt well enough, you know, everything is dominated by health issues, and you want to get to a stage where you just have a bit of normality back into your life.
Yeah.
And obviously I've got a 10-year-old daughter. I wanted her to see mummy being, you know, active and doing stuff again. So, I feel so much better for it. I think it's different for everybody, but for me, it's good for my well-being.
Yeah, no, well, it is different for everybody, but I think also, I don't know, I've spent a lot of time recently I did a job with Macmillan, and they introduced me to a lot of people who've been going through cancer treatment. And one thing they were talking about a lot, and this is particularly relevant to me as well, my stepdad's undergoing treatment at the moment, and they were talking about sometimes when people have had the treatment, it's the bit afterwards that's actually really terrifying, because you've had the shock and the fear of your initial diagnosis, but then there's the course of, you know, the treatment that's going to follow. When that's all finished, that's the bit where you've got to think, okay, how do I reconfigure that experience back into the life I was having before?
Well, I think you feel a bit vulnerable because you don't have that sort of bubble around you.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's that tendency to look over your shoulder, but we don't do that when we get in a car, do we?
No.
You know?
I know.
So that's, you know, what you have to keep telling yourself, I think.
Yeah, that must take, I suppose, that sort of the strength of mind, and also, I suppose, a little bit knowing how to deal with trauma, really, because it's a sort of invisible trauma, I suppose, once you're the other side of it. As you say, like having that thing of, it must just stay in your peripheral vision, because you've had your relationship with your body one way, and then you've got to start thinking about ways it could, you know, harm you, which is a really significant thing to go through. And I know for our family, it's been a really steep learning curve. We've all had experiences with cancer before, but having it very close to home is something that it has concentric circles. You know, everybody's affected by it. So throughout all of this, you've obviously got your daughter. And what was happening at the time when you first... Did you always want to be a mum from when you were young?
I mean, I was, you know, quite ambitious. I, you know, had this amazing idea that I wanted to do the Anne Summers party plan, which is sort of like Tupperware for those that don't know.
How old were you when that was?
I was only 21 when that started.
21?
Yeah. And I remember walking down that long corridor and going into the boardroom to talk to some grey-suited men about my idea. And actually one board member stood up, threw his pen on the table and said, well, this isn't going to work, is it? Women aren't even interested in sex. So I'm very glad to all those women that proved him wrong.
Yeah, and then some.
Yeah, and of course it just took off and it was just amazing. I mean, you know, if you're... To have a business that's growing at 20% a year to a point where I had to stop advertising because I literally couldn't cope with the rate in which we were growing and all the teething problems that went with it. So it's been quite a phenomenon. And, of course, there was all the challenges that went with doing something so different that was, you know, quite culture-changing. You know, sort of all I really ever wanted to do was empower women in the bedroom. But there was so much stigma at the time. And I think the fact that it was always for women only, you know, made a huge difference and sort of created this almost, I don't know, it's like almost like a female institution.
Yeah.
You know, because even our stores, you know, 80% of our customers are women.
Yeah.
So it's been a fantastic journey for me, fantastic, but not without its colour and challenges. Yeah.
So 80% of the customers are female for Ann Summers?
Yes.
Okay. But when you were young, when the company was at the point where you were 21 and walking down to the boardroom, what was the split then?
Oh, it was 10%
wow.
women.
Wow.
And, you know, it was a very male-dominated environment. You'd go into the stores and it'd be like, you know, it was the raincoat brigade that were in the stores.
Yeah.
It was just totally different. And,
yeah.
You know, it's, I guess one of the things I'm most proud of, actually, is the way it has changed so much.
Oh, it's a massive, massive shift. I mean, to go from women being the object to being actually the customer, you can't really underestimate what a massive deal that is, especially when this... We're not talking about a couple of shops. We're talking about a massive, you know, something that everybody sees on their regularly on their high street brand. Mm. This is something that's widespread in every town.
Yeah, we have over 100 stores. We had 140 stores at our peak. And when I think back, you know, I've been arrested twice. I've had a bullet through the post when I tried to open a store in Ireland. And how difficult that was then. And then in 2016, I think it was, I received a CBE from the Queen. I'm thinking, gosh, what a journey, you know. And you can't help yourself but look back and think how it was to what it is like now.
I know. So just to give it sort of a context for me, so when you were 21, what was your role in... Because you'd been working in the company from when were you a teenage?
Well, I did some work experience.
Because it was your dad that was working in the company, right?
He had four stores, mm-hmm. and it was mainly a publishing business then. I had no intention of staying because, as I said, it was a very male-dominated business. And I was just doing some work experience, and I got invited to... And for those listeners that will remember, Pippa D Party, it was like a clothes party over in Thamesmead. And I went along to this party, and the women at the party knew that I worked at Ann Summers.
Mm.
And I remember sort of drawing a picture of my husband's meat and two veg on a piece of paper on top of my head, along with all the other guests at the party as one of the sort of little party games they had. And I was thinking, this isn't quite how I imagined my career starting.
No.
But it... You know, that is where it really started. That's where I got the idea. Women at the party said to me, why don't you do parties for women? We want to be able to buy sex toys, but we're too embarrassed to go into a sex shop.
So when you went to that party and at that point, so they knew about Ann Summers being a sex shop, but presumably they would know it as somewhere where, as you say, the Raincoat Brigade, it had this sort of slightly different look and feel and association. But could you just sense that there was a real intrigue from them about the world of... buying things to enhance your sex life or talking about your sex
life? Totally, because if you think back, I mean, we've been on a crusade for the last, you know, 30 odd years, because women could not buy sexy underwear in the high street like they can today. There was no such thing as a lacy bra.
Wow.
You know, let alone being able to buy something that you want to use in the bedroom.
Yeah.
It was men that made all those decisions.
Yeah.
So, you know, it completely changed. And for a period, you know, the men of that generation, you know, quite uncomfortable about women being empowered. But, of course, that's sort of a culture that's not the case today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You know, when you were talking about the effect of Ann Summers and your decisions and, you know, the exciting boldness of your initiative, aged only 21, it really reminds me of the effect that Madonna has had on the music industry. Mm. Because what you basically did everything sort of trickles down from that point, because now, as you say, buying a lacy bra is something that's very commonplace. Buying sex toys, there's lots of other shops that, you know, cater for women's sexual selves. In fact, I'd say off the top of my head, in terms of the high street, I feel like everything is kind of geared towards the female consumer. I can't really think of a high street place that's more for...
Well, do you know the irony about this? It's so true. 70% of purchasing decisions are made by women.
Hmm.
And yet most companies, most brands are headed by men.
Yeah.
I've never got that. Never.
No, but then it's this in the music industry... When I was 18 and I signed my first record deal, I went for a meeting with at Mercury Records, and I was all excited, and I had such an idea of what a music, you know, a record company would look like, and how, like, on finger on the pulse. And when I got there, I was so disappointed. Mm. It was a load of people sat looking at their computers and using Photoshop, not even like doing exciting, you know, design things or music things, you know, using Photoshop to sort of do like promo copies of CDs. And I was thinking, that's the first thing a fan will own. Why didn't you put loads of work into that? Because that's the thing we'll be really excited about, and turning it over and looking at all the details and trying to work things out about this new music. And then the boss guy, he's a really nice guy, but he was in his 60s, and we were having a chat about music, and he was correcting me all the time and telling me what people my age were interested in. I thought, I'm sat here right in front of you. I'm an 18-year-old girl who's passionate about music. Why don't you ask me? Mm. I'm not saying I'm going to be right about everything, but...
Have you found things have changed?
I think what it is more that you find your people, and then there were some really good people I met around then too, and then they have just continued on a really successful trajectory. So I wouldn't say, I don't think that's been eliminated at all, no. And I think if you have art and commerce working together, there's always going to be slightly uncomfortable bedfellows, because you're going to get people who, you know, think they're in a snazzy job because it's music, but ultimately what they're doing is working with stock. You know, you're making stock and shifting it. So I think it's going to be tricky to eliminate that completely, or even if it's necessary to do that. But I think it's more that I feel that there's quite a lot of exciting thinkers that are peppered in amongst. And when you find those people, you're kind of like, that's the people I want to work with. I feel like there's more options of how to do things. And that's really exciting. And I think it's probably more democratic as well, because now everybody can start their music.
I'm really glad you brought up your music, because I have to say to you, I don't know if you've ever done it, but I did Desert Island Discs with Lauren Laverne, and your record Groove Jet was one of my records.
It was not!
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
Do you know what's funny about that is I knew you'd done it, and when I knew you were coming over today, I started looking up loads of interviews and stuff, and I said to Claire earlier, I had to stop because I thought, I don't really want to know everything. I'd like to discover things. And I thought, I don't want to be correcting you about stories. I think actually, if you'll find, you said it was this. Wow, I'm really excited. Thank you. Is it a nice thing to do Desert Islanders?
Oh, it was, do you know, it was lovely. It was so nostalgic. I mean, I had a little cry at one point.
Yeah, well, music's so powerful for that.
It is so powerful. And it was really, and they were a really nice team. It was all women.
Yeah.
And
Lauren's so lovely.
Oh, she is lovely. It was a really nice experience, very different to what I normally do. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it's so iconic, isn't it?
So iconic.
You know, it felt such a privilege to be asked.
Yeah, it's one of those things you're like, I've done Desert Island Discs. Yeah, no, I mean, people talk about it just as a conversation thing, don't they? What would be your songs for this and songs for that? But I think nostalgia actually is an emotion I feel like I've only just started to understand, because especially if you're someone like me who's had the songs I'm probably best known for happened, you know, 20 years ago, actually. So Groove Jet came out 20 years ago. And, you know, when I was younger, the idea of doing any sort of, you know, singing those songs and people feeling nostalgic would be sort of seen as like a dirty thing. Like, oh, why would you? It's like saying you're not relevant. But actually, I went the other day to a gig of a band called Supergrass, who I used to love when I was a teenager. And I was really excited about seeing them anyway. But going to the gig and hearing all those songs took me back so massively. But also it was so joyful. It was so nice. And I thought, God, nostalgia should actually be celebrated more. It's a really powerful thing. It sort of reconnected me to how I felt back then. And I think music's very good with that. It's a little portal that works better than so many other mediums.
Well, because the moment you hear a record, you usually relate it to something
exactly
that's happened in your life, and it will generate some sort of emotion.
Definitely. And also, if you go through anything tough, I found suddenly all those songs about heartache and, you know, and happiness, suddenly it's like, I get this now. These songs are speaking to me. Everything was like unlocked. And you're so glad those songs are there to reassure you that you're not the first and not the last, but, you know, other people have experienced it. I'll have to listen to Desert Island Discs now, won't I? Yeah. What was the context of Groove Jet?
It was when I started dating my husband.
Oh,
yeah. So
you've been together that long? So
yeah, we've been together about
20 years.
20 years.
Cool. Oh, that's lovely. Well, that's thrown me a bit. I'm trying to think what now I'm speaking to you about. So when you were 21, is that when you did you then start taking over the business in your 20s?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So it was all about the party plan. And then I became chief executive when I was about 25. And then at some point...
That must be highly unusual. Is that a...
Very.
Yeah, very. I mean, I'm not a business mind, but that sounds incredibly young.
And you know, it was also difficult because there were so few women in business. And, you know, wherever I went, it was men. And, you know, it was just, you know, difficult. It was not just because I was a young woman, but also the industry I was in and trying to make the changes. And it was doing extremely well. But, you know, I had people saying to me, oh, this is a fad, give it. You know, give it 2 years, it won't last. And there was a lot of negativity around it.
Do you think they felt threatened by not only your gender, but your youth as well?
And both of those things, but also because of what I was trying to do.
Right.
I was trying to empower women, and I think that was different to what they'd, you know, it sort of perhaps challenged their... And I'm not, you know, I'm definitely not against men, but certainly there were some men that felt it challenged their masculinity.
I think actually women can be just as threatened as well by successful women sometimes too, because some of us are raised incredibly traditionally, but some people think traditionally, no matter how modern a life they're trying to live. And I think sometimes, you know, we can all be guilty of sort of falling into quite lazy ways of thinking about what's expected. And sometimes we do it to ourselves, I think, and that's part of what intrigues me about talking to people about working alongside raising a family, is that I think it is different to being a working father, with the questions you get asked, the way you're thinking, and the amount of logistics is like suddenly... I actually, funnily enough, with my kids, I often think of them like companies sometimes. It's like I've got, you know, five different box files in my head of how each thing is doing and where the priorities are and which areas, you know, we're experiencing growth.
I could imagine that.
Which things are going into the negative. Yeah. But it's like all the sort of project managing I just never thought I'd be doing. But for you, when you became a mum, did you find your business life and the family life, did they work together pretty smoothly?
I mean, my business and personal life tends to blend into one. I think, you know, that's always worked quite well for me. So, and I think it's a way of me maximising my time with my daughter. And it's always been difficult, you know, more so at the beginning, because I think you need to get into that flow and you just think you've got it right, and then it's all out the window and you miss you're late for a school play or something like that.
Yeah.
It is awful for women. I think it is very challenging because we want to, you know, we want to have our own identity and we want to be successful in our own right or do our projects that we want to do. But we want to be a really good mum at the same time.
Mm.
And, but I have learned as I've got older and time's gone on that actually, you know, it's important for us to do those things.
Mm.
And, whilst, of course, you know, like most women, I've had my guilty moments, I also do recognise how important it is for Scarlett to look up to her mum and be inspired by what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And she told me the other day, actually, for International Women's Day, the teacher asked her who inspired her. They asked all the children. And she said, you know, my mummy. And it was such a lovely feeling. Aww. To know that.
Yeah.
And... you know, I want her to grow up believing she can be whatever she wants to be. But to do that, you know, we mustn't... I find so many women... I mean, I run this competition on a Wednesday called Wow, where women tweet about their business and I sort of profile the top three and then I sort of do learning days and...
So it's like female entrepreneurs?
Yes, mm-hmm. And I do mentoring lunches for them. I forgot where I was going with this now. I've gone right off on a tangent.
Don't worry. I've got.
What was I talking about before then?
I think you were talking about women and how we challenge ourselves.
And I just think, what is so... We talk about this. I talk about it to them when we have these lunches. What's so important is that more women do raise their head above the parapet, and that we should boldly celebrate our success and what we've done. And we're so keen to play down our achievements.
Yeah.
But I think it's good for our children to see that, particularly our daughters, because, I mean, I don't, you know, I think so many, parents bring their sort of boys up to be brave and their girls to be perfect.
Oh, definitely.
And there is no such thing as perfect. And, you know, I see it in the boardrooms. You know, I see women that sort of get up and expect, you know, are expected to pour the tea. I've been to off-site meetings with lawyers where they're equal and yet the woman pours a tea and I'm like, well, don't do that, you know.
I know. But it's that thing of sometimes being your own worst enemy with it, I think. I mean, funny, Claire and I were just literally chatting about this morning about how many times I've made things really muddy and I've actually confused people with the signals I'm giving out. Because in my head, I want to be quite capable, assertive and clear and unapologetic. I swear, the main thing I'm striving for, I think, the older I get, I really want to get there. It's just the desire to apologise for everything all the time. I just want to eliminate that from my life. I feel like that's a really... it really sets you back if you start off a lot of your sentences with sorry but, or, you know, apologising for things
Why
going
do
wrong.
Do that?
I don't
Why
know.
Why do we do that?
I actually don't know.
And then, you know, as woman to woman, I look at you and I'm in awe of what you do. Five children and working at the same time, I think, is phenomenal. You know, I struggle from time to time having just the one.
Well, I think it's the same. I do think it's the same issues. I think it's just, you know, everybody's got different ways it manifested. But actually, I think the issues of having one is actually very similar to having lots. It's just probably I shortchanged them a little bit more in terms of the time they get. And they're a lot more used to asking me to do something and then me going, I'm really sorry, that slipped through the net. I think I kind of have to go for the basic thing as being good enough most of the time anyway, because I can't, going above and beyond is like something that I don't always have time for, really. And hopefully they'll forgive me one day.
And do you know, I don't believe that's the case. I remember talking to somebody one day and saying to them, but I really want to do this, whatever it was, because, you know, I want to be an awesome mummy. And my daughter overheard it and said, but mummy, you are an awesome mummy.
Aww.
And I think we just beat ourselves up, don't
yes.
we? I think we're too hard on ourselves.
Definitely. Yes, I think so too.
And don't you think when you're a working mum, you actually try that? You know, you often try harder because you're trying to compensate. So I'm sure it all evens itself out in the end.
Yeah, I did actually hear a really inspiring story about you once. There's a lady called Lisa that came to do your hair once, and she's a really good friend of mine called Lisa Lauder.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was talking to her on the phone. She's one of my kids' godmothers, and I adore her. And she was hearing me. I was going, oh, you know, this has gone wrong this week, and the house, you know, I'm finding it really tricky, and... You know, I can't remember what happened, but so I was finding that everything was getting a bit chaotic. And she said to me, well, actually, I just did this lady's hair, and Jacqueline Gold. And she said to me that in her house, she writes everything down and tells everybody things. And she said, because it's written down, everybody just knows what they're doing. And I was like, that's inspired. I'm definitely going to do that.
So she's, I mean, I know Lisa very well.
Yeah.
And she's just, she's obviously noticed that I am a bit of a list maker.
Oh, but that's brilliant. And do you sit down and have regular meetings with everybody?
I've got to be honest, I am super organised.
Yeah.
And I think if you have got your life jam-packed with so many things, for me, it works. It's the only way I can do it is if I can be that organised. I guess, you know, I'm a team player anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I'm very, very lucky to the people I do work are just great. And we're all like-minded, and I think that's the important thing. I think if the people around you, you know, you need to share the same values and work in the same way, and I think that helps and works. So it does work for me.
So do you find that the way that you handle your working day and the way that you handle stuff in the home is actually quite similar in terms of approach?
It is, really.
It's not like two different hats.
It is. My husband's constantly reminding me.
Right.
Don't you bring your work home, don't you?
Right.
But he's just... To be honest, he's just got used to me being super organised.
Yeah, and do you, if you need to get things done, are you the sort of mum you thought you'd be? Like, with pre-baby, you look at the kind of mother you are and think, yeah, that's pretty much what I thought would be the case.
I don't know. I think life is so different when you have a child, that first child. And I'm definitely more emotional, more connected.
Yeah.
And I think I don't think you ever know what you're going to be like.
No, I think you're right, actually. Although, I say that, I think I thought I was going to be a bit stricter, actually.
Yeah.
I'm a lot more relaxed about things.
Are you?
Yeah, which I think I think it does suit me better. I think maybe because there's...
And do you find your husband is therefore more strict?
He's quite relaxed. I don't mean that we're not... There's definitely boundaries. I think that's pretty essential. And kids really actually crave that. I think if they didn't have that. So there's lots of continuity. There's lots of safe predictability in their world. And I really care about that. But I think it's more just when things go a bit wonky or how I handle it if I feel like their behaviour isn't what I want or they're not doing the things I feel they should do. I think I'm better at sort of trying to find a different way. Because being strict actually doesn't work for every kid anyway, I don't think. Some children really respond if you get quiet, head teachery. But for other kids, then, well, definitely like my first one, I think, responded better to that. If I start getting a bit stern, that would really upset him. He hated to see me cross or sad. So he would immediately shift his behaviour. The next one came along and he would just argue back. So I had to kind of try a different tactic, really. So I think they've kind of taught me different skills that I needed, really, that I wouldn't have known how to do before.
I must admit, I wouldn't describe myself as strict, but I do carry through. So if I say I'm going to do something, as much as, you know, it might break my heart to do, I will carry it through because, I just don't see the point in empty threats.
Yeah.
But I always try and coach her at the same time and explain things to her, and I think I've always done that.
Yeah.
I had a situation where she searched something on her iPad. This is like about a year ago now, that she shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
And it was following... They'd had their first sex education at school. And then, of course, what do? The first thing they do is they go on their iPad and they search sex. So I was mortified, told her not to do it again, and then, of course, she did it again.
Yeah.
So I took the iPad away. That was a year ago. I've only just given it back.
That's quite a... is it ironic that that was what it was?
It was a bit. Well, you know, you say that, but I mean... children are curious.
Oh,
that
yeah.
is part of life, isn't it? They are going to do that. And I think maybe you could say I was a bit naive to think, as a parent, not anything to do with what I do, but as a parent, it's a bit naive to think they're not going to do that.
No, I've had exactly the same situation with one of mine with an iPad. He'd had a friend over and I didn't... They'd been playing and then when I reached for... The sort of family iPad, and I thought I just need to look something up, and what had been looked up just before me was hot girl boobs.
Oh no, it's history.
And hot girl boobs starts out quite innocent, but it gets quite adult really, really terrifyingly quickly, which is my naivety. I had no idea. We've got family filters and all that kind of thing, but I think you've still... And actually, that was really tricky because having a conversation with kids, and I'm all about every conversation, every subject, they can talk to me about anything. I think there's a way to make it age-appropriate for whatever you're talking about, but because of what he'd searched for, I felt like I had to touch on lots of issues, which I was finding quite challenging, like saying, well, just because you could see some boobs doesn't mean you're allowed to see any boobs. And... yeah, it was really tricky with when they're still primary school.
I mean, so she's 10 now, so she must have been about 8 at the time, or 9. I was 9. She was. I was mortified.
Yeah.
So I got some. I rang the school for advice. I got some age appropriate books because I suddenly thought, you know, she's ahead of the curve. I need to explain.
Well,
this.
Maybe not ahead. I think they are starting to hear those words in the playground around then. And what I've heard is quite a good thing to do is to ask them if they've seen anything that worries them and ask them, because we might be able to know immediately what it is they've seen, but they might actually not really know much of what they've seen. And also, as a sort of reassuring thing, I think pretty much everybody can probably remember the first time they saw a glimpse into that adult world. And it probably is for everybody around that age, around sort of 7, 8, 9. It could be mucking about a friend's house or... something you heard in the playground and thinking I need to know more, or a book that's a bit high up on a shelf and it's got a section in it where you think, oh, not sure about that. You know, it can even be a sort of medical health book and you think, not sure these pages are intended for me. I think everybody's got a memory of that, and I think, you know, so long as communication lines are open, that's probably the best thing you can hope for, because I think the worst thing that kids can walk away from is either feeling sort of hugely concerned or frightened or, you know, confused by it, or feeling sort of a shame, because that shame, as I'm sure you would know lots from all the research into your, you know, potential customers, that shame around sex and those things can last a lifetime, actually, if from when you're really quite young, if nobody's there to say, Well, that's all there.
I think
there.
We're so much more open in our conversation, or you'd like to think we are today. I know I certainly am. And like you say, it's about that age-appropriate conversation.
Mm.
And letting them know that your whatever you, action you've taken is to protect them, and that, you know, they're not quite ready, you know, from an age point of view.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember saying to Scarlett at the time, you know, this is, there are things on the internet that aren't real, or they don't represent
exactly
normal life, you know.
Yeah. I mean, so when Scarlett, because you said she's come to work with you sometimes, so does she not, to her, are you, is your line of work just sort of business rather than knowing too much about context of it?
She to her, she just knows that we do lingerie because she sees it on my my screensaver. So no, she doesn't know about the sex toys. It's not, she's, you know, it's not, I'm sure in the future she obviously will, but
yeah,
she's 10, nearly 11. It's,
she'll probably be incredibly blasé and brilliantly sort of unfazed by everything, which will be, what a gift is that for a young girl to just be able to walk through that adolescence and teenage years.
But they find out most things at school, don't they?
Yeah, it's true, actually.
So they always seem to know more than you think they know.
I think that's true, but also they're not, they don't need to learn everything from us, actually. And I think I'm always reassured when I remember that I am the mother, which is a really important role, but I am also just the mother. There's all these other people and the, you know, all these other areas of things they can get information and have conversations. And I think that really takes the pressure off me a little bit, really, when I remember I don't have to deliver a complete package of the growing up, you know, and I'd have to deliver them at 18, like, okay, I've given you all the knowledge, you know, it's okay for it to come from different places. Mm. And, you know, they learn on their own about all of it.
It's part of growing up, isn't it?
It is, it is. And you've got to have the bits where it's gone a bit wonky. And they've also got to do the bit when they push us away, which is, you know, it's all part of it.
Mm.
But then they do come back, I'm sure. I don't know. Well, we definitely have with my mum.
I'm dreading that moment.
No, but it doesn't really work like that anyway. It's fine because then, I mean, I live 10 minutes away from my mum and I went away with her a couple of weeks ago and it's like, I think the good will out.
You have a 15-year-old, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Is that a girl or a boy?
A boy. I've got all boys just to make it nice
you?
And easy for you to remember.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's what I could say about the he looking up the hot girl boobs and no one's identity is revealed.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a... Yeah, it's got lots of tiny men in the house. Well, not so tiny, actually. My eldest is just over 6 foot.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, that's quite weird. If I get my baby, who's one, and I hold him up above me, like, one day you're going to be here. Yeah, one day I'm going to be like their little mum. How weird is that? Yeah, that's a little way off, but probably it will come around quicker than I think. Yeah, but yes, it's all these boys. And I'm so determined to raise boys that, you know, can recognise and encourage strong women in their lives. Mm. And I think they've actually got a lot of examples of strong women. Yeah, they've got a lot of that.
And I guess you're watching football matches and...
You know what, we're not. That's the thing. None of them play football. None of them are that interested in football. I might be one of the little ones, might, when they're older, but at the moment, no. It's quite techy. They're quite a lot into the tech stuff. And there's definitely quite a lot of play fighting and that kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, I remember my brother and sister doing that. I suppose I'm normally a little bit, I wouldn't go so far to say defensive, but I try and encourage people to understand it might not be exactly what you think I go home to, because most people pull quite a face when I say I have five boys and they're like, I've literally had a guy. I remember when I'd had my, it might have been my fourth, and I took him, I think he had like his 6 week check at the hospital or something. So it's like the first time I'd gone out, just me and the baby, like, okay, let's go out into the big wide world and we'll get you there and back. And this old guy sat next to us on the tube on the way there and he said, oh, little boy, is this your first? And when I said fourth, he went, oh, dear God. Oh, God be with you. God be with you. He was so sort of, he felt so profoundly sorry for me. But it was so like OTT, I actually found it really funny. But is your daughter quite similar to you, do you think? Is she quite motivated with her work and getting things done and the lists and things?
I mean, she's doing well at school, but that's only really come in the last couple of years. We're both creative.
Ah,
so
that's a lovely thing to
share.
So we
love doing painting and stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a bonus. She's very willful.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that about her.
Yeah.
She's also, what I love is that even though she's an only child, she's very confident and funny and loves, you know, engages with adults quite well, which I guess is because she's an only child. So she definitely has got her own, you know, some of her own sort of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do see some of me in her as well.
It must be quite hard to tell off kids when if they're showing that sort of willfulness, because for you, like so many, I know that man in the boardroom who threw his pen down and said this will never work about the Ann Summers parties. There's sometimes when you've got a feeling in the pit of your tummy that what you're doing is the right thing, meeting up, coming head to head with it and seeing that happen, there must have been a part of you that thought that kind of gives you that extra fire. So when you recognise that trait in your daughter, it's like kind of rooting for her a bit, like, yeah, go on. It's good to be assertive. Yeah, I know I find that with mine. And actually, I think I can sometimes be a bit too sympathetic, like, oh, I know, I recognise that from me. I think it's quite a powerful tool, isn't it, when you're parenting. As you've been such a successful businesswoman for such a long time, your career was so, you know, established by the time you had your baby, did you find it tricky to shift and give time to yourself and let the business sort of do its thing in a slightly more different pace, or did it not really feel like that?
It was quite a difficult time for me, actually. It's sort of bittersweet because Scarlett was a twin, and she had a baby brother as well who was very poorly when he was born, so he passed away 8 months later. So we went through a very difficult time. So, you know, it was difficult getting a balance, because, you know, we take Scarlett to see Alfie, and you know, we've actually got some nice video footage of the two of them together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everything to do with work just obviously was totally up in the air and sort of went on hold. And then when he sadly passed away, it was then a case of, and I'm sure there will be parents out there that have been in this situation, sadly, where you've got your own grief to deal with, but at the same time, you want to be strong for your other child.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of is challenging, but sort of helpful at the same time, because it makes you... you know, have to deal with that. And, you know, we've always sort of kept Alfie in the conversation. We've always done things to keep his memory alive,
yeah.
which has been nice, because in a way that means he's still here.
Yeah.
And particularly for Scarlett being a twin, you know, there's that extra connection, which, you know, I've sort of had to manage that. But, yeah, that sort of made it difficult. But, you know, you have to... In some ways, you have to get on with life for the sake of the other child.
Well, yeah, I'm sure saying it's difficult is, you know, sometimes language doesn't really do enough to help us, because I can't imagine how awful that must have been to go through. And I when I've tried to think what it must be like to lose a child, I think I would want everybody to speak their name. I'd want to sing from the rooftop, like, so everybody knows that they existed, they were here.
Mm.
So I can very much understand why Alfie has got to be part of everything forever. He was here, he's a real person, he's Scarlett's little brother, he's, you know, your other baby. I think there's so much awkwardness when you experience something that is everybody's biggest fear. I mean, who knows how to deal with experiencing the death of a child. It's just, it's the thing that most people, if they even start the thought, they go, oh, that's just too terrible, I can't think about it. And I think, I mean, my mum went through something traumatic, and she described it as like becoming a member of a club that you never wanted to be a member of. And you'd probably find other people that have been through similar things, but it's very much the story of your family and what happened.
And also, you know, you go through life never thinking those type of things will happen to you. And then when you suddenly find yourself in that situation, it's like, well, words don't describe how that feels.
Mm.
And how you cope with that. It's, you know, you'd never think you could possibly cope with that. And of course you do, you know, suddenly finding yourself having conversation, you know, really difficult conversations, and talking with medical people and, you know... the midwife and all of those challenges, and even giving birth, which is supposed to be a really joyous time, you know, that's what I, and even now, you know, just every year when it's Scarlett's birthday, you know, we're having a birthday party one minute and going to the cemetery the next. You know, that is quite, you know, those mixed emotions all in the same day is very difficult.
That is. I mean, are there things that you would say would be good for people to know how to handle situations like that if they find it happens to a friend of them or something? Is there things that people did or said that were really helpful, or is it just people feeling it's okay to bring it up and talk about it is helpful?
I think, first of all, you know, how you deal with it with any other children. You know, sometimes, even now, Scarlett will go to bed, and Scarlett has a tendency, if she's tired, she can be a bit emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll say to me, "Mummy, I can't stop thinking about Alfie." And I'll say to her, "Let's do a little prayer," and we'll sit down at the end of the bed and we'll do a prayer together. And that always helps her, and it makes her feel better. It makes me feel better. She feels like she's communicating to him. So that's something we've always done. Also, we did... we made a big chest. I had I got this sort of like treasure chest. He always had this pirate theme in his bedroom. So we got this treasure chest painted in a pirate's theme, and we filled it with all his special things. And every now and again, we'll go through those sort of memories together, which I think is nice. Mm. And within our own family, we talk about it often, but not so much outside the family. But equally, you know, if it comes up in conversation like now, it was part of our life. So, you know, I think you set the tone.
I was going to say, certainly when I was talking to you today, I thought, well, I'll take my lead from you, because I would never want to bring up something really painful if you didn't feel comfortable.
And I think people will take your lead. Mm. You know, if you don't bring it up, then maybe you don't want to talk about it. But like you said, you know, Alfie was so important to us.
Yeah.
I can't talk about Scarlett without talking about Alfie, you know? And you know, you want to celebrate his short life as well. That's equally important to me.
It's really really special, I think, that Scarlett will be able to feel she has that way of communicating with him in a way that acknowledges and accepts how she feels, because grief and those emotions are not a chronological straight road. You know, you can have, from what I understand, you can have a day where it feels like a long time ago and another day where it feels like it was just yesterday. And maybe when you were doing the Desert Island Discs and thinking about the music, that must bring things back.
Oh, totally.
So viscerally.
At his funeral, we had a record, Wishing on a Star, which the Rolls Royce record.
Oh, yeah.
Which I loved, always loved. But obviously it now has a different meaning.
Mm.
And, you know, couldn't help getting tearful. But, you know, I think that is the way it is, you know, and we shouldn't, you know, you don't know how you're going to react in those situations. And if you get upset, you get upset. That is nothing to be ashamed of or uncomfortable about. But it's, you know, it's all part of our life story, isn't it? It's part of what we've been through.
Yeah, exactly. It's all, that's the life you had. I think that's the thing. When I had my first baby born early, so Sonny was born a couple of months early and he was in hospital, and some people, I mean, it's by no means comparable, but it's obviously not the traditional and accepted ending to a pregnancy. And, you know, people weren't really sure how to talk to me about it, whether they should congratulate me or not. And obviously you've had a baby that turns into a patient immediately, which, you know, it's what we've both been through with that. But I think that the thing I always felt like was a sort of slightly pragmatic part of me was like, well, this is just, I was never going to be still pregnant with him. He was either going to be, or rather, he was never going to be at home with me. He was either going to be in hospital or I'd still be pregnant. So I think you just get on with the reality of what you know. And as you say, that is just what happened to us. That's our story. And that's how life shapes you. There's so many things that happen and, you know, you're hoping for is the good stuff. I think the thing that can be, you have to be careful of, I suppose, is if you have what's to your mind a sort of a charmed life or a successful life, that you don't feel that there's anything that the scales have to be cast in one way. Like, life doesn't work like that. Fate is not sitting there somewhere thinking, you've had too much of a good thing there, we've got to do that. Mm. It's just that's just what happens to people. And talking about it and being open often reveals so much that other people have gone through too. I love the human connections that can happen out of the more traumatic things. But I think it's still something culturally we're not maybe that brilliant about a lot of the time. I think it's, well, it, I suppose it's just, it's awkward, isn't it? You don't want to, no one wants to make someone feel really sad if they feel like they're getting through the day and it's working for them.
And also, as the person that's been in that situation, you don't want to make other people feel awkward.
Mm.
So, but, you know, I think that, I think as a society, we do handle these things better than, you know, say 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I
would agree.
Social, you know, maybe one of the positive things that's come out of social media is that people are more open, aren't they?
I think so. I think so, definitely. And the more you, everybody continues to talk about the things that are affecting them, you know, mental health issues, all these things, the less taboo they become, the more commonplace.
And you know what? The great thing about podcasts and like what you're doing is, you know, it doesn't make people... People don't feel alone.
Yes.
You know, it's helpful to other people.
Yeah.
That they know that if it's happened to them, they're not the only ones.
Massively. And actually, talking of that, when I was initially thinking about having these conversations about working mums, one thing I thought is I really don't want it to feel that for every woman out there, either work or family life is the thing that is like the icing on top of everything, and that, you know, you can be doing your work, but hey, if you become a mother, it's going to access all this creativity and this drive you didn't know you had, and it's really zhuzhy and amazing. It was more to reassure people that if you find yourself trying to work out if you can retain your sense of self and still continue to lead a life that satisfies you, it's actually possible. It's, you know, you're not going to suddenly find yourself homogenize and lose your identity just because you've become someone's parent. And it also made me think a little bit about all the many women out there that must be already thinking that they want to start a family, and for whatever reason it's taking longer than they want. I know I grew up with my stepmom doing many rounds of IVF, and I was thinking, I wonder if, I know that's something you experience, and I wondered if there's a sort of almost like a third lane of traffic really when it comes to the sort of whole idea of being a working mother, which is that you've also got the, you know, you're not, if you're decided already that you want to have a baby and you're going about a really intense process of trying to become a mum, I wonder if everything's already begun to change for you, and you're actually, you found yourself a mother without a baby, if that makes sense. I don't really know. I don't know if that's how it feels.
Well, I've been married twice, so I got married very young in my 20s. You know, my husband was a Catholic boy, and he, in fact, I was 20 when I got married to him, which, by today's standards, is far too young.
That's very young.
And certainly was for me. I mean, we were married for 8 years, together for 10. Because you change so much.
Yeah.
And we didn't have any children, thank goodness. And I was always one of those people that I wanted... Of course, I did want to have children, but with the right person. And then, of course, by the time I met Dan, I was that much older. So... We just decided that we would go the IVF route, because you could spend ages waiting and then find it's even, you know, later. And it was, gosh, it was a really difficult time. I mean, we were successful on our fourth try. But it really challenges you as a couple.
Yeah.
It really challenges you as a couple. And we actually broke up for a period of time.
Yeah, it must be. I'm not surprised the strain it puts a relationship under.
It's an awful strain, and we did it in this. We tried it in this country 3 times, and mm-hmm. then we went to America, and did it. And actually, the attitude was so different.
Oh, really?
It was something we really noticed. It was very process driven here, and very sort of, quite difficult in having to do, you have to do counselling and all of, but when we did it in America, it was just such a positive, they have such a different way of doing things sometimes, which suited our personalities, I suppose, mm-hmm. in the sense that, or certainly suited mine, because it was more when than if.
Hmm. Well, in America, that's how they were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
it sort of suits the idea of having American, like, they'd just be like, okay, we're going to make this happen.
Well, they do have that positive.
Yeah.
They have that positivity. And funny enough, just changing the subject, I remember that being the case when I started business. You know, I remember going to a conference in America, and everybody was celebrating each other's success, Whereas I think at that time, you know, we people that are successful sometimes find it difficult to talk about it because, you know, but they have just a totally different way of doing things. And of course, our culture has changed. You know, we see things like Dragon's Den and, you know, other The Apprentice. You know, there's a bit more of a difficult culture here, but I would still like to see more celebration of women in business and women realizing that they don't have to be aggressive to be successful.
I think that's a massively significant point, actually, that we're not trying to emulate anyone else that's gone before. It's all about bringing our own strengths to the table.
Totally. And, you know, I know we're talking, I'm going off on all tangents here, but, you know, one of the things I talk about women being successful, you know, even in my own business, is you do not need to be loud to be successful. But you you do need to contribute if you're in a career, maybe. You know, I'm as a CEO like to see women put themselves forward and speak up and talk about their ideas. Sorry, that's my pill reminder. If you tap it, it will stop.
Yeah.
Don't worry. We already had like a conversation about grout, or we're having a really proper conversation about IVF. I think it's funny. We've been talking in lots of people's homes for these podcasts, and everybody's home is so much more significantly quiet than my own. It's really annoying. They're all tidier than my house, and they're also more quiet. It's really annoying. Sorry about that. I'm so sorry about all that. So we're talking about the importance of women not being aggressive. I know that. Do you need to take a pill?
No, it's fine.
I don't want to make anything bad.
I actually think it's great having all these sounds in the background. I almost wonder why do we cut them out? Because this is real life, isn't it?
To be honest, we probably won't cut them out. I actually feel very sick. The only thing I don't want is for people to get like thinking that I'm just sort of like, I don't know, that they're trying to like focus on you in amongst like all this other. So long as it's enough that we can hear us mainly, then I'm fine with it too. Because I'm very able to have a conversation when lots of other stuff is going on, because you learn that skill, don't you? Not just from having kids, but from being a musician. There's often 10 different things happening off. So you're like, you have to be able to be directive with your attention. And I know I did want to ask you, was your mum a working mum? I know we've heard about your dad, but was your mum a working mum?
Yeah, no, she wasn't. I mean, she was a very traditional upbringing. Dad went to work, you know, mum stayed at home. And it was funny because I think even when I went into business, that was sort of a bit alien to my mum. She's passed away. She passed away about 16 years ago, so I wonder what she would be thinking of me now.
Well, she saw, I suppose, all the beginning, but what was she thinking when you...
Yeah, I think she was really proud.
But yeah.
Obviously, you know, things have evolved and gone on, and I think she would be really proud, but probably also nervous for me at the same time, because I think, you know, parents at one time, it was only boys that grew up and went into business. It's not something that girls did.
That's frighteningly recent, actually, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Doesn't go back very much. Even, I thought my grandma was a working mum, but she wasn't really. She stopped when she had my mum, and that was it. They just stayed at home, and obviously absolutely nothing wrong with that, but it's all about just having choice is the big empowering thing.
And I think there was a period though, and we're probably talking, you know, 30-40 years ago, there was a period where, you know, it was sort of frowned upon girls having careers and you know, having children and not maybe, you know, still carrying on with their career.
Yeah,
you know, there was that added guilt.
Yeah.
That, you know, there was a view that mums should stay at home.
Yes.
And look after their children.
Definitely. Well, I think still now you can be punished for it. And also there's this weird flip thing where if you are someone that is seemingly from the outside world very successful at what you're doing, then probably you might call yourself a parent, but you've probably got a fleet of nannies and you're probably not really doing much that. We've got all these weird judgments that are made, not by me, I really don't think like that, but you know, you hear it and you see it, and I think it's so bizarre. Why are we not just sort of doing lots of thumbs up? I think people have to remember so much that other people's destiny has got so little to do with what goes on in their life. So why do you care if someone else's?
Plus, I think everybody's life setup is very different.
Yeah, I mean, massively.
You know, I'm very fortunate. My husband works from home, but my mother-in-law lives too far away, and obviously, my mum's passed away. You know, some people will have, you know, grandparents help out during the week, and So I think everybody, you know, uses the resources that they have.
Completely, absolutely. And everybody's just trying to make it all work, actually. And unless you're one of the people in that family life, you probably don't really know what's going inside it. So you should probably step back from being too judgmental. And nobody's getting it right all the time. There's loads of bits where it does go all a bit wonky and wobbly. You know, and it's that, I suppose there's a sort of Instagram idea of how everything is, where you can feel, oh, they've really nailed it, and what about me? And actually, I do think I do that to myself sometimes. I sort of have a kind of Mumsnet forum somewhere in my head where they're kind of tapping away saying, well, that's fine. It's fine if you want to do it like that, but personally, I never would. Yeah. But I think I've got better at recognizing that no one's really feeling like they've totally nailed it.
That whole judgment thing, it's so destructive. So destructive and negative. And like you say, who knows what's going on with people's lives?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it does feel that maybe the tide is turned. Well, I think from the next generation, they might be a little bit better at thinking a bit about what goes on. There's been so many things culturally, whether it be happening to people in their real lives or through TVs and dramas and stories, and even my 11-year-old son's assembly today was all about being kind and trying to see people for who they really are rather than, you know, stigmatizing them. I do hope that they're going to be, we place so much emphasis on kindness now with kids. I don't remember being told half as much to be kind when I was small. Maybe we were.
Oh, totally not. I mean, you know what, I think the way schools are taking on that social responsibility as well is really important.
It is.
And you know, I remember when we were looking for schools for Scarlett, in fact, we'd just been looking for a senior school. And of course, we always, you know, as parents, we now say, well, what's your pastoral care? What's your policy on bullying? What's this? What's that? You know, my parents probably didn't ask that question. It just wasn't a word. You know, it wasn't a thing then. So I think schools, you know, it's heartening to see how that's changing.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think they're realising that the more holistic support you can give individuals, the better they tend to cope with life in all directions, really. And that actually there's lots of, you know, without sounding too kind of Americanized about it, there's so many ways to succeed other than just, you know, making it an A or a 10 out of 10 or whatever. It's about sort of growth of a person, isn't it? And that whole collective thing of it taking a village to raise a person actually continues right the way through till... Actually, it's probably even later than I would have thought. It's probably like in your 20s. I was actually thinking, because some people say, oh, it's going to be weird when the kids have left home, which obviously is a long way off, but I just feel like they're never going to have left. I think there's always going to be one here, like, coming back. I just can't picture that they'll all be off at one point. But yeah, no, it's kind of... I think we're having a slightly more protracted childhood in a way with that as well, and people are taking a little bit longer maybe to find their profession. We don't have job for life in the same way the previous generations did as well, so... And everything casts a shadow. That can also be quite overwhelming. I mean, I wonder for your daughter what she'll want to do when she's older, because having a mother that's done so much must be awfully inspiring, but also, you know, it can also make you feel like, what's the thing I do? Where's my thing? It sounds like she's going to find it, but it's just, I think, you know, when your parents do the thing that they love and they do it in a way that's managed them, see them through a lifetime, it's, you know...
Yeah, and you don't stop worrying about them, do you?
No.
I think that I've always told her that she can be whatever she wants to be. You know, there's no pressure on her from me to, you know, continue in the business. The great thing about kids is they change their mind from one week to the next what they want to do.
Yeah.
One minute, the thing that she seems to be quite consistent with is she wants to be a pilot. So one minute she says a pilot, the next minute it's a teacher, then she wants to be an artist, you know, she's... and I guess I think we're much better at letting them find their own thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Rather than putting them under pressure to be a lawyer or a doctor or any of those sort of perceived, you know, perfect...
Yeah, stable jobs.
Careers. And I think that... you know, when we were looking at schools for her, actually, it was finding an environment that we felt that she was going to be really happy in and that she, you know, she could flourish in. And I think, you know, it's encouraging. And you know, I think as well what she ends up being passionate about will be the thing that she's really good at.
Yeah.
So...
That's the happy...
I'm hoping she will find her passion.
Yeah, I think that's my big hope for my kids too. I think it's the one thing where you think that way every day... doesn't feel like work in the same way, does it, if you're connected to your job in that way.
And I'm sure with what you do, you know, that is probably epitomises that.
Are
your children musical?
Some of them, but not... I don't know if
I
it's going to be their thing.
The
there's musical instruments everywhere, yeah. And the piano over there and guitars. And yeah, there's stuff everywhere. But I actually have a feeling that it'll be something, maybe a couple, if that. I mean, they definitely, my eldest ones, the eldest two, got very different passions, actually. They love music. Well, the eldest loves music, but I don't know if that's the thing he'll end up doing. I think it was almost too obvious, you know? It's so obvious. Mm-hmm. Like, my husband and I are both musicians. As I said, there's music everywhere in the house. I think it's like, it's a bit like they need to find something else.
As long as they find something that they love,
yes,
you'd be happy, right?
Oh, so, yeah, so
that's
happy.
Same for me.
Although I think if they were one of those people that paints themselves silver and stands in Piccadilly Circle,
yeah,
I'd struggle
okay.
with that. Yeah, there's some things I'm like, ideally not that.
Or a pole dancer or something.
I don't know.
Somebody's...
I watched J-Lo at the Super Bowl doing her pole dancing. I thought it was pretty incredible. But then I guess she's not just doing that. There's more to it than that. The only other thing I want to ask you, just a sort of silly thing, really, because I've had it sometimes where my working life and my sort of family life have clashed in a way that isn't maybe ideal. Like when, I don't know, when kids have come to festivals and ended up sort of wandering on stage halfway through my gig and things like that. I did wonder if you'd ever sort of opened your work bag and found like toys next door, like the sort of potential new range of sex toys for the shop or something like that. Doesn't have to be that literal.
Oh, right. I have opened like up my notepad to a meeting to find Scarlett has, you know, scrawled a funny face or something on the notepad. I don't think there's been anything.
It's not like, if she doesn't really, if there's things that, you know, she has to wait till she's older to see, I suppose you're not kind of like hastily like screening off something or like going, swerving her around a different corridor at work
saying.
Or something.
I mean, she's visited me in the office a couple of times and, you know, there might have been something a little bit obscure on the desk and so, oh, that's just, you know.
You could have like one of those prohibition things, you know, where it goes from like a speakeasy and you press a button and like the table flips
like
around.
Like a transformer.
And, yeah. Suddenly it's like, it's all just like a normal office.
Yeah. No, we've not had any embarrassing moments.
Oh, that's good.
So I'm sure they're to come. I mean, they get more embarrassed, don't they, in their teens, I think.
Yeah, it's one of the unexpected joys, actually.
So I think I've got all that to come.
Yeah, but it's actually really fun. I didn't realise how fun it would be to embarrass kids. It's really, I quite like it. And maybe that says more about me than you. Oh, thank you so much for talking
you.
To me. And you'll be happy to know it sounds like the grouts arrived while we've been chatting and you've got to take your pill and there's all these exciting things happening in our lives.
Yeah, such is life.
Yeah, yeah,
it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you. So that was Jacqueline Gold. What did you think? Do you see what I mean about her gentle voice? It's true, isn't it? But when I listen back, I can really hear the radicalism of what she did. It's pretty incredible, isn't it? I mean, you know, as she summarised herself, she's had death threats, she's been arrested, she's had a bullet in the post. This woman has dealt with a lot, but it hasn't stopped her. And actually now she's tackling menopausal women and their sexual selves. Again, this is still pretty new, pretty groundbreaking. And maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe we should have come further, but that is where we're at. So, you know, we just got to deal with it and move forward. And thank goodness there's women like Jacqueline around to think about these things and do something about it. Next week, I am joined by Julie Dean, who you may or may not know. She set up a company, which you probably do know, called the Cambridge Satchel Company. And the fascinating thing about her is that she set it up in a number of months based on a spreadsheet of ideas she had, of various ideas that she thought could generate enough money to pay for her children's school fees. I think she had about 3 months to get started, summer holidays to get on with it. And she didn't just do that. She's kept growing the company. It's getting bigger and bigger. And she even advises the government on small businesses and helps entrepreneurs. So she's very, very cool. And we chatted in the most quiet of all places, the British Library. So, yes, come and join me next week. And thank you very much for joining me this week. And thank you to Jesse, who is sat next to me, who's been very, very quiet while I'm talking. Thank you for being so quiet, Jesse. Did you enjoy this week's podcast?
Yes.
Very quiet but sincere, yes. All right. See you next week. Have a good one. Take care of yourselves. And see you soon. Lots of love. Bye.
Can you put them on telephone?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.